Music, information, local news, radio drama. All part of the great Southern Sounds of Melbourne. 88.3 Southern FM.
This is the Space Show, and this evening's The Space Show can be summed up in one word and one acronym. The acronym is...
NASA. NASA.
But with due respect to Onyi Jalamo, this is not Kenya's political movement, the National Super Alliance, but rather the United States' National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which is 60 years old. We take a look at NASA in talk and music. Oh, and the word? Well, the word is news. This is The Space Show, which is presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. I'm Andrew Rennie. Let's now turn our attention to that acronym, NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration of the United States. It opened its doors to business on 1958, October the 1st, 60 years ago. Since then, it has gathered many fans. But not everyone is a fan, as is explained by the United Kingdom's comedian Alex O.
Tried to talk to people about NASA? Huh. Why banging your head on a brick wall, right? Well, this song is all about that. Sometimes it's best just to keep your mouth shut, right? And don't talk about NASA at all. Listen up. When I started talking about NASA, I lost all my friends. So I don't want to talk about NASA ever again. My friends don't understand me, and I wish they would. I tried to tell them about NASA, but it don't do no good. No, I don't want to talk about NASA ever again. 'Cause every time I talk about NASA, I lose another one of my friends. Yeah, every time I open my stupid mouth, something about NASA comes flying out. No, I ain't gonna talk about NASA again. Well, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. You can tell people about NASA, but you can't make them think. Well, they look at me and they roll their eyes and they shake their head, 'cause they believe the papers and the TV instead. No, I don't want to talk about NASA ever again. 'Cause every time I talk about NASA, I lose another one of my friends. Yeah, every time I open my stupid mouth, something about NASA comes flying out. No, I ain't gonna talk about NASA again. See, I just want my friends to know all of NASA's lies. I hope one day my friends wake up and they realize. But I feel like I'm banging my head on a wall every single time. If I just got me a bunch of new friends, then I'll be doing fine. No, I don't want to talk about NASA ever again. 'Cause every time I talk about NASA, I lose another one of my friends. Yeah, every time I open my stupid mouth, something about NASA comes flying out. No, I ain't gonna talk about NASA again. So I went down to the local bar to meet me a bunch of new friends. Well, I had myself just a couple of beers and started talking about NASA again. Well, things got kind of ugly, and I was punched to the floor. No, I ain't gonna talk about NASA no more. No, I don't wanna talk about NASA ever again. 'Cause every time I talk about NASA, I lose another one of my friends. Yeah, every time I open my stupid mouth, something about NASA comes flying out. No, I ain't gonna talk about NASA again. One more time, boys. No, I don't wanna talk about NASA. Ever again. 'Cause every time I talk about NASA, I lose another one of my friends. Every time I open my stupid mouth, something about NASA comes flying out. No, I ain't gonna talk about NASA.
I do hope you don't share the views of Alex O, the English comic singer who goes by the pseudonym of Conspiracy Music Guru. That's because the remainder of this evening's The Space Show is unashamedly about NASA. We have a quarter-hour documentary about the birth of NASA, a sample of the NASA art program, an insight into the role of women in NASA, and some songs about NASA and the things it does.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Well, 25 years ago, Lynn Bondurant prepared a documentary to describe the birth of NASA. The chief executive officer, the boss, if you will, or departmental head, is called the administrator. The first NASA administrator was Keith Glennon. The topics covered in this quarter-hour documentary include why NASA was formed, the major imperatives of the Space Act, Eisenhower's thoughts about space, some details about precursor organizations, and the beginnings of Project Mercury. So this is the birth of NASA.
Hello, I'm Lynn Bondurant, your host. What is happening in other American science and medicine the year before NASA is born? Well, 1957 is the year the American Cancer Society reports a high correlation between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. And new element Nobelium 102 is disclosed by the Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont, Illinois. Overseas, on October 4, 1957, the Soviet Union launches Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite. The Soviet's launch is for the International Geophysical Year, or IGY. The geophysical year is 18 months from July 1957 to December 1958. More than 70 nations and as many as 30,000 scientists cooperate to investigate the world and its environment. Sputnik 1 concerns Americans because of far-reaching military and technical implications of the launch. Less than a month after the first Sputnik, the Russians launch a second Sputnik, which weighs about a half a ton and carries a dog as a passenger. The second Sputnik causes even more concern in America because of the large size of the satellite. During IGY, the United States plans to launch a Vanguard satellite, which weighs just a little over 3 pounds. The attempt to launch the Vanguard on December 6, 1957, ends in failure in a ball of flame and wreckage. Keith Glennon is the first administrator of NASA. He is asked why NASA was formed.
That's a fairly easy question to answer. Sputnik. On October 4th, 1957, as I recall, the Russians launched a fairly heavy object into orbit, and that caught us really by surprise. The Vanguard project had gotten underway in 1955, as I recall it, part of the IGY program, International Geophysical Year program, but it wasn't anywhere near ready. They had, I think, scheduled some launches late that year, that is in 1958, but it wasn't clear that they were going to be able to fly them. There was another competitor which had really never been recognized, and that was the Army with their Jupiter, which together with some upper stage solid rockets developed by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, finally was the vehicle which launched a satellite for the U.S. early in 1959.
And the satellite was called Explorer 1. The United States space effort before the launch of Explorer 1 is fragmented. Navy, Army, Air Force, National Science Academy, and NACA. President Eisenhower appoints James Killian to be science advisor just after the first Sputnik launch. Keith Glennon recollects the writing of the Space Act, which forms NASA.
My recollection would be that Mr. Killian, who was the president's science advisor, had been appointed almost immediately following the launch of Sputnik. And PSAC, the president's science advisory committee, and I suspect Mr. Lyndon Johnson on the Hill did a sort of a cooperative job in putting together the Space Act. They had as a model the Atomic Energy Act. And indeed, if you compare the two, you find a good deal of similarity in many of the clauses in the two acts.
I see. Well, what were the major implications of the Space Act?
They simply said that we were to pursue the development of activities in space for the benefit of all mankind. We were to do it as a civilian agency. We were to be responsive to the military in the sense that if we found in our developments some gadgets, some information that would be of value to the military, we were bound to give it to them. And that was really the thrust of this act. We were also told that we should pursue international activities. And this is, I think, an extension of this for the benefit of all mankind.
The Space Act is signed into law by President Eisenhower on July 29, 1958, and on October 1, 1958, NASA comes into being. Glennon recalls Eisenhower's feelings about space.
He was not a space cadet. He used to say, as you look over his shoulder and you say, you know, Keith, that moon's been there a long time. It's going to be there a great many eons yet. And we'll get there one day, but it isn't necessary we break our necks and break the budget to get there now.
Okay, what about congressional support at the time?
Congressional support was really very good. As a matter of fact, they were pushing us. I don't think in my 20 months there that I ever had a budget proposed to them that they didn't want to add something to. My stock answer was, I have studied this, we have presented you with a budget which is what we think we can usefully use. If we need any more, you may be certain I'll come right back to you. That seemed to satisfy them.
Before NASA is born, Keith Glennon is president of Case Institute of Technology and former commissioner of the Atomic Energy Commission. Then Eisenhower nominates him to be first NASA administrator in August 1958 with Dr. Hugh Dryden as deputy. And NASA is formed from the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. Glennon explains.
And we did inherit the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics operation, NACA as it was then called, of which Lewis Laboratories was one. There were four or five such laboratories, three big ones, Ames, Langley, and Lewis, and one at Wallops Island in Virginia, and one out in Edwards Air Force Base in California. But we had 8,000 well-trained, loyal, dedicated people in NACA, and they formed the base on which we erected NASA. So we were very well endowed.
NACA was formed in 1915 to supervise and direct the scientific study of the problems of flight with a view to their practical solution. NACA was required to direct and conduct research and experiments in aeronautics. The committee was responsible for many of the advances in U.S. aviation through 1958. Some space-type research is done in later years, but emphasis was on airplane research. Again, Glennon tells us what happened in NACA space research.
NACA had been doing development work, largely at Langley, as I recall it, on the shape of a capsule that might be used in an up and down flight like actually Mercury started out to be, and finally into an orbit. The problems of trying to get adequately capable people in a variety of fields meant that we had to look other than in NACA, and it became apparent very early on that our real limitation was in the launch vehicle business, the booster rocket, as we then called it. We really didn't have any. We had been using sounding rockets, small things that went up and accumulated information and telemetered it back to the United States, to the ground, but we didn't have anything that really would lift very much with any degree of surety. So I guess it was probably in November, might have been late October of 1958, that I made a trip to Huntsville with Hugh Dryden, my deputy, and one of the very, very great men in this space program. His name cannot and will not ever be forgotten. We came back. It is clear that von Braun had a real strong team there, very capable. We did try to get that laboratory, or part of it. I didn't want the whole thing. They had work going on for the Army. The Pershing missile was in development at the time. And they had as their really scientific support the Jet Propulsion Laboratory managed by the Caltech out on the West Coast near Pasadena.
Dr. Glennon is successful in his effort to continue the job of building the new NASA organization. Officials transferred JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, to NASA, and the role of the California Institute of Technology as JPL manager continues. About a year later, officials transfer a large segment of the Army operation at Huntsville to NASA, and workers build it into the Marshall Space Flight Center. Only a week after NASA comes to life, Dr. Glennon approves the first U.S. manned spaceflight program, Project Mercury. Not only is NASA working on manned space travel, but from early on, scientists launched space science probes. Workers launched the Pioneer 1 probe toward the moon about a week after NASA comes into being. A lunar TV scanner is aboard. Because of an error in burnout velocity, the probe does not reach the moon, but reaches an altitude of almost 71,000 miles, and the craft re-enters the Earth's atmosphere over the South Pacific on October 12, 1958. Glennon remembers that first Pioneer.
I guess we sort of broke our pick on some of those. I recall those were the Pioneers, as I recall it. And I recall how overjoyed we were when we could talk to that little bit of a thing. It's about this big, so fashion, 200,000 miles out in space and get the information back. It never did reach the moon or go into orbit around the moon. It failed and fell back to Earth. But at the same time, the Soviets could never talk to their birds more than 10,000 miles up. So we were beginning to get a little sense that we were doing things right, that we were getting better all the time. And that was indeed the objective of NASA in those days. Push the state of the art as hard as you could, but don't waste your muscle.
The United States tries 37 satellite launches by December 1959. Less than a third are successful. As a result, NASA begins to instill a new sense of rigid quality control to check and check and check again rocket components, wells, valves, pumps, materials, and so on. Over time, the quality control program works. In other areas of science and engineering, the first domestic jet airline service begins between New York and Miami on December 10, 1958. And in August 1959, plans to explore Antarctica in 1959 and 1960 are announced. In September 1959, Severo Ochoa and Arthur Kornberg received the Nobel Prize in Medicine for chemical heredity work. Meanwhile, the first seven U.S. astronauts are chosen. Early in 1959, NASA selects a team of seven engineer pilots for Project Mercury. M. Scott Carpenter, L. Gordon Cooper, John Glenn, Virgil Grissom, Walter Schirra, Alan Shepard, and Donald Slayton. The astronauts prepare for flight. Early on, veteran test pilots look down on the role of the pilot in Project Mercury, but the Mercury pilot plays an active role. He controls the capsule's attitude and pitch, roll, and yaw, as well as operating navigation and communication systems. In all Mercury flights, the pilot proves to be essential to the success of the mission. He operates all primary flight controls and initiates retro rockets to fire, beginning the descent to a landing. I'm Lynn Bondurant.
And we have more about NASA, celebrating the 60th anniversary of NASA on this evening's The Space Show.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
Where this is The Space Show, celebrating NASA. Now, our next song is a celebration of those working at NASA. These people who push the boundaries of what is known. So from Eric Horner, we have Those Who Dare to Dream.
Imagine isn't just our job, it is our call. The future belongs to those who aren't afraid to challenge what we know. To push the human mind farther than we ever fathomed it could go. What we learn tomorrow could change the way we see so many things. History is made every day. History is made every day by those who dare to dream.
From its earliest days, NASA has engaged photographers to record its activities. It also has had cinematographers. Later, it engaged artists to paint, draw, and interpret the activities of NASA. And this became known as the NASA Art Program. And then they began to branch out and engage musicians as well. Our next song was written by Tina Clark for the NASA Art Program in 2002. It's a celebration of spaceflight and peace. It's called Way Up There, and it's going to be sung by Patti LaBelle, who is a Grammy Award winner. Way Up There, Patti LaBelle.
So, Miss Tina Clark. Up there, where peace remains, where silence thunders, and angels sing, imagination, amazing grace. Bring us closer, closer, closer to that perfect place. The stars are gathered and illuminate to lead us safely. Hey.
We heard earlier that NASA selected 7 male astronauts for the Mercury program. Then some women began to say, hey, what about us? What about us? And in the end, 13 women were tested. They're now jokingly referred to as the Mercury 13. Wally Funk was one of those. And this is her story about her astronaut training in the 1960s. And then we hear a little bit about what she's been doing since then.
I get a call, said, do you want to be an astronaut? I said, oh my gosh, yes. And he said, be here on Monday to take these tests. I had needles stuck in every part of my body, tubes running up my bottom. So I went along with it. It didn't bother me. And then they said, we want you to come with a swimsuit. You're going to go into the isolation tank. Well, I didn't know what that was. The lights come down. They said, try not to move. Well, I didn't have a whole lot to think about. I'm 20, had $10 in my pocket. And then finally they said, Wally, you were outstanding. You stayed in 10 hours and 35 minutes. You did the best of the guys that we've had and of the girls.
So, Wally, you went through all of these tests only to find out that the program had been shut down.
Affirmative. When we got the telegram, that was it. And I never heard anything more. So I went on about my own business. I'm not going to sit back and pine over anything. I applied to NASA 4 times. And finally they said, Wally, you know, we're sorry, but you don't have an engineering degree. I said, well, I'll get one. So I never let anything stop me. I know that my body and my mind can take anything that any space outfit wants to give me. High-altitude chamber test, which is fine. Centrifuge test, which I know I can do 5 and 6 Gs. These things are easy for me.
I know that when it's your time to go up, I'm going to be right there cheering you on. You are probably the most fearless person I've ever known in my life. But I don't think you truly realize that you have been not only my hero, but my mentor. I went through a very nasty divorce, and you made a phone call at the right time one afternoon that saved my life. You said, Mary, let's go flying. I'd say, Wally, I can't afford to go flying. You said, I didn't ask you that. Meet me at the airport. And taking me flying, you would pick out a cloud, and you'd say, Mary, you see that cloud up there? I said, yes, ma'am. You said, point the nose of this airplane toward that cloud and just fly to it. And it was the most freeing feeling. I felt like I was in charge of something when I was in that airplane, and that helped me to put myself back in charge of my own life. So, yeah, you fixed the problem. Every night at 10 o'clock, you and I will call each other, and we discuss our day, what went well, what didn't go well, and we call it our 10 o'clock flight. So we go up into the clouds together, because Wally, you've always told me, when you have problems, go to the clouds.
The story there of Wally Funk, and I'm sorry, I do not know who the Mary is that's referred to there in conversation. Well, NASA's been come a long way since those days. You may remember the movie Hidden Figures, which told the story of the female computers that assisted with NASA and back in the early days and right through. Here's a song celebrating the achievements of the women who work at NASA. It's by Grace Potter, and it's called Look What We've Become.
Initiate Grace Potter mission.
You to keep your head down. They told you not to run. They told you we're sorry, but not the fortunate one. They told me to keep it quiet. Said my day would never come. So I screamed my lungs out and I ran straight for the sun. And they all told us we would be nothing. Look what we've done. Look what we've done. And they always told us we would be.
Grace Potter there. Look what we've become, celebrating the achievements of women who work at NASA. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory was mentioned in that documentary we heard about, and also we heard in the news about the Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity. So here's a song by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory employees, and it's called We're NASA and We Know It.
We're not EDL, time for 7 minutes of flaming hell. River's touching down, everybody pass peanuts around.
Yeah, we have mission control.
Getting full use out of every soul.
What?
Just 25 feet left to go. It's curiosity, look out below, yo. Crane lower that rover. Crane lower that rover. Crane lower that rover.
Nanette and the bug gal.
Crane lower that rover. Crane lower that rover. Crane lower that rover.
Nanette and the bug gal.
Kicking at my console. This is what I see.
Okay.
Data streaming back from curiosity. I got stars on my hawk and I ain't afraid to show it. Show it, show it, show it. We're NASA and we know it. We're NASA and we know it. Yo, we're gonna look for ice. Gotta calibrate, gotta be precise. And we're gonna raise the mast. Panoramic views are unsurpassed. This is how I roll. Baking red rocks in my nuclear stove. We headed to the peak with my laser eye. No one to bury me when it's time to die. Crane lower that rover. Crane lower that rover. Crane lower that rover.
Nanette and the bug gal.
Crane lower that rover. Crane lower that rover. Crane lower that rover.
Nanette and the bug gal.
Shout out to Carl the Sage
and
Neil the Grass Tea. Shout out to JPL and the Rocker Bogey. We're better than SpaceX and we ain't afraid to show it. Show it, show it, show it. We're NASA and we know it. We're NASA and we know it.
I'm not